Accession number 4627, reel number 2.
Army Film Unit, Roy Bulting, reel 2.
Now, the Ministry of Information Films Division was really the most magnificent example of the British at their best and their worst, I think. I don't know how true it is, but I'm told that when the ministry was first set up and already Hitler's films had some impact upon the neutral countries, so they said, well, we'd better have a films division. I believe that it's true to say that that they said, well, now pictures. Now who do we know? Who's good at pictures? And then a man called Sir Kenneth Clark was then the head of the National Gallery. You know, portraits, oil paintings, drawings, so on. So pictures. Sir Kenneth Clark found himself at the head of the films division. Now, Kenneth Clark, cultivated, charming, and as well as stimulating man, but place him within the jungle of Water Street to deal with some of the really tough characters that have always floated around the film world. He was totally inadequate. But he had recruited a lot of very able, civilized human beings, but from areas quite outside films. So really the first year or so of action within the films division was pretty disastrous, pretty appalling, I would have thought.
Did you support the critical views expressed in Documentary Newsletter?
Well, I can't say that I'm sufficiently familiar with the arguments that they may have been advancing. I wasn't a regular subscriber, but I would see it from time to time. It was very much a publication in which Bill Doakes of some documentary company praised the work of Harry Dobbs in another company, and then vice versa. It was, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. I always had the strong feeling that, and it was the case being advanced within that paper, it was very special pleading, and that they were all they were almost rather like a persecuted sect, that it was being written by documentary filmmakers for documentary filmmakers. I have no doubt in my own mind that they could have played a more important part in the first year or so of the films division, because they had been dealing with reality, or what they purported to be reality. I forget that it had some kind of little slogan. Documentary film is reality treated creatively, or something, some little tag like that. So, of course, if somebody stood in front of a camera who happened to be a bricklayer and was, say, laying bricks and talked in the way that most people who are not trained actors talk, in other words, totally untruly, but because he said it in a certain way, I am laying these bricks, and for 32 I put them on this block here, And that's what I'm doing. That, of course, is not a bit as he would have said it in real life, but faced by a camera crew, and a microphone, He then spoke quite unnaturally. This was taken by the documentary voice, I mean the pure documentary voice, as being an indication of reality. Treat it creatively.
Another of the aims of the documentary newsletter was for much better coverage of the military operations of the war. Were you sympathetic to this?
Well, I never read that, you see. The certainty in my mind was that, of course, and indeed as the war progressed, as the neutral countries were increasingly terrified by these wonderful documentary films produced by the Nazis, that is the one about the Polish campaign?
Baptism of Fire.
Baptism of Fire. And Victory in the West. The two films that went all over the neutral world and thoroughly intimidated all those people who saw them. They were brilliantly done. Therefore, we had to do something that was the equivalent. Mind you, for the first, until 1942, until El Alamein, there was very little we could do about it because our record was one of failure. Nearly everywhere until the war gradually turned round. But that we should have been, but we had to do something eventually, is, in my view, indisputable.
When did you first come into contact with army filming yourself?
Well, yes, well, very interesting. I was trained very expensively. I joined the 53rd Training Regiment at Mooltown Barracks, Tidworth, Salisbury Plain. I was there for, I think, about 12 weeks, in the course of which my squadron leader sent for me, and he said, look, we've had a circular. You were in films, weren't you, before the war? I said, yes, sir. He said, well, he said, they're hunting for people who were in films. But you don't want to go to films, do you? I said, no, sir. Of course, I did, mind you. I did. So he said, oh, quite right. He said, quite right, it's ridiculous. right. So, all right, about to turn around, I'll have to go. I went out, and a few weeks later, I was sent to the Royal Military College at Sandhurst.
Can you remember the dates?
No, I can't. You're asking too much. No, I can't remember. And then, after so many months of training, I was commissioned in the Yorkshire Hussars, in the Armoured Corps, Yorkshire Hussars, and was duly dispatched to Catterick up in Yorkshire. So then I sat in my can for a hell of a long time because my regiment was out in the Middle East. There was no means of getting me out there at the time. And then I was on leave in London and I ran into David MacDonald, who was then the head of the Army film unit, and he was in the War Office. And I think they occupied two rooms. That was really the start. They occupied two rooms in the War Office. And he said, Roy, I said, what are you doing? I tell him, I said, up at Catterick sitting on my bum. I'm doing nothing. He said, well, why aren't you... He said, well, it's very difficult. David, I know the circular went round. He said, look, if I can put it through, will you come and join? I said, yes, of course I will. So as a result, back in Catterick, I suddenly was summoned to say, look, Belding, there's just been this demand that you report to the War Office immediately. I said, yes, sir. So that is how I joined the Army Communist. Now, what is interesting is that having been trained as a tank officer and having been seated on my bum doing nothing at all for a hell of a long time, within 2 weeks of joining the Army Film Unit, I was away to Norway on a commando raid. And in the course of 24 hours, I saw more action, more violent action, than I had experienced for the whole of the war.
That was the Vågsøy raid.
That was the Vågsøy raid, yeah.
Were you in charge of that expedition from the filming
side? Yes. I had a man called Harry Rignold, who unhappily was subsequently killed at, I think Salerno. A splendid man. Great courage. And then Harry Watt came along. I didn't know exactly what his role was, but, you know, he was a terrific documentary filmmaker, and he was a great power of, great tower of strength to the whole ensemble. And there was a man called Jack Ramsden of British Movie Tone News, and there was a stills cameraman. They're all the names are coming back to me now all of a sudden, called Ballandine. And I think myself, that I think made up the whole of the troop. And I must say, of course, it was very much a set piece. No matter where you turned your camera, there was something happening, you know. And from the moment we landed in the early morning to the moment that we returned to our ships steamed out of the fjord, wherever we turned our cameras, there was action. And that very rarely happens in terms of battle photography. I must say, the following day, I couldn't understand. I had terrible ache on either side of my face. And it took me quite a time to realize that I was so petrified that I had been clenching my jaws so tightly that the muscles on either side, you know, were aching.
Were you and the other cameramen then in positions of great danger?
Well, look, everybody... on a job like that is in danger. You know, it's one of those kind of things. But there were three Hamden bombers who were to give us cover as we got into the assault landing craft. And we each had different points to touch down. When they were supposed to drop smoke bombs just in front of us so that our landing would be hidden, and one of them dropped one of the smoke bombs right bang in the center of one of the landing craft. Everybody went up, you know. As we were moving in towards the town, this little village, I remember I was with Harry Watt, and suddenly there was a great ammunition dump that went up, and we just rolled over into a ditch, you know. And happily I had the IMO camera, and although I just turned it up on this great mass of stuff going up, pure luck. But you couldn't help getting material. The danger doesn't give me any excitement at all. I am not by nature someone who plunges into danger voluntarily. I think that perhaps like a lot of soldiers, you sometimes do things because you're afraid of being seen to be afraid.
Coming ashore, were you all in the same landing craft?
Oh, no. I forget now. We were... I know that Harry Bott, I know, was with me. And I think Harry Ridbold, yes, that's right. I think Mallandyne and Jack Ramsden were in another landing craft. I couldn't be absolutely certain on that one, Kay.
As a film director, how much control did you have over the proceedings?
I mean, virtually nothing. All hell was let loose. I mean, there was one thing. Because of the what was being planned, there was a fish factory, an oil factory, that the commander was planning to destroy. I knew that was going to be destroyed if we got into the village. At that point, I was able to say to Reno, look, come, let's get here. We never knew what the hell was going to happen. The charges were being laid, we knew, and it was going to go up any moment. Now, what would happen? How much they were going to use in the way of explosives? We didn't know. But we got ourselves into a position where we could get a good shot. In fact, the factory just exploded right into camera. And, you couldn't help taking effective pictures. I don't know if you've seen any of the material, but just...
One of the impressions one notices, looking at the material now, is the absence of any Germans. Was this a problem at the time, did you feel?
Well, you see, you don't... I saw my first dear German on that raid, I remember vividly. He was lying in the snow. A terrific amount... of staff, of course, was censored. It was censored at the behest of the Norwegian authorities because there were so many Norwegians who we brought back with us on the packet boat, the converted cross-channel steamer, the HMS Prince Charles. You don't, it's very rarely that you see the enemy. I mean, if you can see the enemy, then either he's a dead duck or you are.
Did you receive full cooperation from the military authorities for your filming?
Yes, the Colonel Danford Slater, who was the commanding officer of the number 3 commander, and his very young adjutant, whose name I think was Hillman or Stillman, Alan Stillman, I'm not sure. They were splendid, and they put us right into the picture, told us exactly what the objectives were, and it was a very limited operation. It was intended to provide combined operations under Mountbatten with some kind of experience. It was a trial run, so to speak, as well as give a little fillip around Christmas time to the morale and the spirits of the British people.
Did you draw any lessons from the way the camera coverage of the raid had gone?
I didn't think there were any lessons to be learned or to be unlearned. The lessons, I think, were entirely military. And those, I think, were learned. But in terms of battle coverage, this was very much a set-piece operation. You couldn't help getting good, effective battle material, although some of the best of it was, in my view, removed, I mean, that of necessity. But it was also clear that from it one could see that you required a good team of cameramen, that they had to be trained as soldiers as well as being cameramen, and that you needed very, very many more on the ground than really we had two cameramen. I have nine, and happily I knew how to operate it, but that's about it, you know.
After that raid, what was your association with the Army Film Unit?
After that raid, I made, I think, one or two short films that were in the pipeline. And then...
Had you been taken on as a director or as editor or in a specific capacity?
Well, I think they thought of me as a director. But then director, editor, that kind of material has to be edited and, you know, that has to be shaped. And so I was really, had a certain amount of equipment in terms of experience in both areas.
That you were going to be on the creative side rather than have anything to do with the administration of the unit.
I was never very much good at that, and I didn't think they, I don't think they needed me for that, you know. But
who took charge of that? Did they, David MacDonald?
MacDonald was the CEO. And then at a certain time, he went out to the Middle East. And then his job was taken over by
Hugh Stewart?
No, I think it was taken over by Alex Bryce, another Scot. Have you heard of him?
Yes, I have.
I think it was Bryce. Then, after fiddling around with these short films, I think that's when, in 1942, I came out to make Thunder Rock with John at Denham. And I was out for 6 months. And then returned. And there was very little happening. Again, some more shorts were churned out, you know, for these 5 minute films that the Ministry of Information gave to the cinemas each week. I seem to remember one called The Army Lays the Rails. But there was nothing, you know, to really engage one until one day had a Sergeant Richard Best and a Sergeant Frank Clark and a Corporal John Durst. They were all in the editing department. And Best asked me to go and look at some material. He'd come back from the Middle East. And he had been sort of assembling. And I really was grabbed by it. I mean, very much. There was something that made me feel this is going to be important. I didn't know why. Until the following day or the day after, I was up at the War House. And for some reason, and I hope this is accurate, I went down, and I believe it was a man called Sir Leonard Woolley, who was an archaeologist of distinction. And he was sitting in the tombs, you know, beneath the War House, as an official historian. And he had a day-by-day diary of the war. Now, at that time, you won't remember, but there had been this shuttling, you know, between Egypt and Tripoli, and back again, and Tobruk, and we had fallen back to El Alamein, and as he allowed me to read this diary, and I remembered seeing this material. I mean, I'm not a military man, but even the dullest layman could see that one of the great and critical battles of the war was going to be fought at El Alamein, and that if they got through there, that the Middle East was going to fall, our oil supplies were going to be eliminated, and industry and the war effort was going to be destroyed. This, of course, set me thinking, whatever this battle is going to be, it's going to be critical. Therefore, we must have a film ready. And with the aid of assistant adjutant, a man called Lieutenant Norman Ness, I started to put in requisitions for film material, for prints. And you had to get it approved. It had to be under some kind of budget for some kind of film. But with his aid, putting it onto various films, I got all the print material I required from the material coming back from the Middle East. And so El Alamein was, of course, unique. Again, it was one of those rare things. It was a set piece battle from the north, from the sea, down to the Qatara Depression, where the soft sand started and was impossible to track the vehicles. The tank couldn't use it. It was only a matter of something like between 30 and 40 miles. So a defense in depth could be organized. If that defense was destroyed, then so was the British war effort.
So you were responsible for the genesis of the film, The Desert Victory?
Yes.
Unprompted by the military?
Unprompted by the military. And indeed, what happened is that the battle commenced on November the 24th, I think. And we already had three reels of cut film, of film cut, the lead up to the battle. So all we had to do was to wait for the material to come back. And then I conceived the idea of, in fact, trying to make the battle intelligible to the